This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. A few years ago, strange reports began coming out of upstate New York. Researchers were going into caves that were usually teeming with bats and finding them empty. In some cases, the bats were still there, but they were dead, almost all of them, victims of what came to be known white nose syndrome. Soon there were mass bat die-offs across the Northeast as the disease spread with incredible speed. 2 years ago, white nose syndrome was found in North Carolina, in the mountains, for the first time, and sure enough, more and more empty caves. With us in the studio to tell us about bats and explain what we know about this disease is Martina Kalkunas-Rupel. She's Associate Professor of Biology at UNC Greensboro. Martina, welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Frank.
Also with us on the phone from Asheville, Gabriel Grader, a wildlife diversity biologist and state wildlife resource with the State Wildlife Resources Commission. And she's been leading bat surveys in caves and mines in the mountains for the past few years. Gabrielle, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Martina, tell us about bats, because they're cool, but it turns out they're important, too. So tell us about their importance.
Sure. Well, it's important to remember that bats are mammals, first of all. And so that means that they are animals with fur. They feed milk to their offspring, and they have a particular jaw that allows them to chew from side to side, just like ourselves. And bats are the only mammals that have evolved true flight. In the U.S. and Canada, we have about 45 species of bats, and the majority of those species do one thing, and that is that they eat insects. They're nocturnal, so while we're sleeping, they're flying around and feeding on insects. And ecologically, this is really important because they are top predators of insects at night in both aquatic and terrestrial systems. So as top predators, what they're doing is they're controlling insect numbers. And this
See, the interesting thing to me is that this is a natural insecticide. So if we had more bats, we'd have fewer insecticides that could affect the bees, and on and on we go.
Right.
So give us a white nose syndrome. Tell us a little bit about the symptoms of white nose syndrome.
So the syndrome itself is caused by a fungus known as Geomyces destructans. And this fungus is a cold-loving fungus that grows on the exposed skin of bats. And bats have exposed skin on their ears, their muzzles, and on a large surface that's their wings because they're flying mammals. And this fungus has growing mycelia or vegetative parts that grows into the glands of the skin and into the skin itself.
And the cold part is important. They love cooler temperatures,
right?
In the 45-degree range, something like that?
Right. So the cold part is very important because something that's a particular feature of this syndrome is that it infects bats when they're hibernating. And so bats are insectivores. And in most parts of the U.S. and Canada, it's too cold in the wintertime for insects to be flying. So the bats don't have food during the wintertime. And about half of the species that we have deal with this by going into hibernation. And what bats do when they hibernate is they look for a dark, humid, cold spot. They slow their metabolism down and their temperature drops. And that's how they make it through the winter. And they have a very tight energy budget to make it through this winter. They make it through the winter by putting on fat reserves before they go into hibernation. And even though bats are hibernating, they have to wake up periodically during the winter to drink, to urinate, to reposition themselves. And this waking up is really expensive. What white nose syndrome and the infection with the fungus does is it causes them to wake up more often. And by waking up more often, they basically spend all of their fat budget on those wake-up periods, and they become emaciated and don't make it through the hibernation period.
So, Gabriel, up in the mountains, what have you seen? I mean, you've been out just the past few nights looking for bats, is that right?
Mm-hmm. What
are you seeing?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we've been seeing really devastating declines in our winter surveys. We have sites that we've been monitoring for many years prior to white nose, and which means going into these caves and in the winter and counting the number of hibernating bats and identifying them to species, and you know, now at some of these sites where it's been 1 to 2 years since we found white nose in North Carolina, we've seen up to around a 95% decline in the number of hibernating bats in these same caves that we had monitored prior to white nose. And surprisingly, despite that happening, last summer when we did surveys in western North Carolina, we were still actually catching a lot of bats and a lot of these cave hibernating species. However, we're just getting started this summer with doing some surveys this summer, and we went out not last night and then the night before to try to catch bats, and we use these big mist nets that go across corridors that bats fly through, and we basically try to trick them into flying into these nets, and then we capture them and record data on them. And we actually did catch a lot of, we caught a decent number of bats two nights ago, and so it was a little bit surprising because it was a colony of little brown bats, which is one of the species that affected the most. So we are still catching some bats in the summer. We're not really sure how that's going to play out and what the connection is going to be there, and if, you know, and maybe there's a sort of a lag time on, on seeing the effects in the summer as much.
What is the ratio, Matina, of the hibernating bats to those that don't? Do they make a big proportion of the bat world?
So to put some numbers on it, we have 45 species of bats in the U.S. and Canada, and about half of those hibernate and half of those don't. And it happens that, and it just makes sense when you think about the weather patterns of the continent, that if you're above the 40th latitude, those bats are the ones that hibernate. If you're south of that, those species don't hibernate. And there's a few migratory species in there. But we happen in North Carolina to be right at that point where we have the some of the southern extent of the hibernating species and the northern extent of those non-hibernating species. And that really is one of the really unknown questions about white nose syndrome, is how those species that are at the more southern end of the distribution are going to deal with the syndrome, and whether mortality is going to be as high where winters aren't as cold.
Well, let me just speculate. I mean, one of the things is energy loss. You talk about being expensive to wake up. Part of the expense is that you can't replenish. You can't go to the ATM because
exactly.
There ain't no bugs. But here, maybe where there are more bugs available in a warmer climate, it might have less effect?
Well, potentially, but it's more that the bats would hibernate for a shorter period of time or not have to hibernate at all. And you're exactly right. One of the behavioral characteristics of white nose syndrome is you have bats that should be hibernating that are active at the front of the cave and are even flying around during the wintertime. And so what they're trying to do is either find water in case they're out of water balance or find food to replenish those reserves that they're using to make it through.
So we save the bats through global warming. Global warming is the answer.
Well,
forgive me.
Right. So, I mean, that has a question has come up is, what's the link between global warming and, let's say, white nose syndrome and some of the other wildlife peril, some of the other wildlife species in peril, like amphibians or the bees that we were just talking about. But one thing about white nose syndrome is this is something that's happening in caves, and it's happened very rapidly. So, you know, over the last 6 years, we've seen massive amounts of mortality and temperatures inside of caves that are really important both for the bats and for the fungus have not changed over that time. So there could be indirect effects of all sorts of things like a changing climate and pesticide use and globalization. But something else is going on here, and it's happened in a very quick amount of time.
How about this fungus? Has it been around for lots and lots of time, or is it relatively new new on the scene?
So that's something that people are looking into right now, but there are sort of two alternatives. The one that has the most support is that this fungus is new to North America. There are bats in European countries that have had the fungus isolated from their skin, and they don't seem to suffer the mortality associated with having the fungus like the bats in North America do. So it could be that newly described fungus, which it's newly described with right nose syndrome, has been in other places and it's been brought to North America. Or alternatively, it's been here for some time and something's happened to it in recent decades to make it affect bats in a much more negative way. But I think the evidence so far looks like it's the former and that it's a new fungal species.
It's a new species.
Here.
Mm-hmm. How does it spread?
So there's direct evidence that it spreads from bat to bat. There's also some good evidence that it can be moved around by people, potentially by people that visit caves on their gear and on their boots. And you mentioned in New York, where it was first discovered in the winter of 2006 and 2007, it was discovered in a cave that was visited by thousands of people each year. And the spread has gone from New York State to 22 states and 5 provinces in 6 winters over 2,000 kilometers. So it has potential to move very quickly and has moved very quickly thus far.
Well, Gabriel, although the potential for humans to spread this, how does that affect your bat watching, bat catching activities?
It has a really profound effect, actually. It's completely changed the way that we do our work. Everything takes a lot longer and requires a lot more equipment. We're going to, as a state agency, and we're going to great lengths to minimize and hopefully eliminate chances of us actually spreading the spores of this fungus from location to location when we're doing our surveys and monitoring. And so that involves putting, you know, in the winter when we go in these caves, we're actually wearing special suits and rubber boots and rubber gloves, and we're like duct taped in, and everything afterwards that goes in, you know, that's gone in the cave either gets thrown away or goes through a strict decontamination procedure.
Is there any effort in North Carolina or anywhere? I'll stick with you, Gabriella, for a minute, just to ask if there's been any effort to eradicate this, or if we know enough about it to begin an eradication campaign.
Well, there's been a lot of research going on to try to understand more about this disease and why, you know, and how it's spreading, and more specifically, and then why it's, you know, it's affecting different species of bats differently. And there's a lot of work looking into that, trying to figure out why some of them seem to be doing a little better than other species. And so a lot of that research is aimed at trying to figure out something we can actually do to directly help the bats, like some kind of treatment or something to kind of buy us some time while we, you know, figure out something else that can be done. But right now we're not at a place of actually being able to do anything on any kind of large scale. A lot of the things they've come up with have been tested in the lab for like different types of fungicides, and it's a really challenging issue to deal with because, we're talking about really sensitive cave ecosystems that they're not just important for the bats. There's other creatures and natural, you know, there's bacteria in there, all sorts of things that are part of the little cave ecosystem, and we don't want to destroy that in trying to help the bats.
Right. You can't just go in there and spray bat medicine and hope that nothing else will happen, because we know it will. Now, let me ask you this, Martina. Is this just not natural selection at work? These hibernating bats may die out and leave a niche for another creature, different bats or other creatures.
Well, it's a good question. So throughout history, you know, over the past millions of years, there have been lots of, you know, extinction events that have happened naturally. This is a little bit different in that we haven't seen these sorts of mortality rates across multiple species in a mammal in North America in recent history. So it's really important to put this into perspective. So we were just talking about honeybees, and that's a single species. We have at least 7 species of North American bats that are being impacted by white nose syndrome. And if we think about other loss of other species, you could count them on your hand, like if we lost bears and bobcat and foxes and raccoons all at the same time. That's the analogy. So we're losing a number of species at a really quick rate within a really small amount of time. And that's what is not natural about this. And there are things that are going on with these other wildlife issues that sort of make us have to ask the question about what is going on in sort of a more global since.
Gabriella, the infection infestation in North Carolina is relatively recent. Have we seen an impact yet, and are people up in the mountains worried about the ultimate effect of this?
Well, I would say there's definitely, we've had a really big effect going on. It's, you know, in the first year of 2011, we found white nose here. We still had a lot of bats in our caves, but they were starting to show up with more and more visible signs of the fungus growing on them. But this year, you know, we have caves that we used to have thousands of bats in, and now there's only 5%, approximately 5% left. And that's, we've seen that in multiple sites that we've monitored, that we're just not seeing the bats in our caves very much anymore. There's some variation in that. Seems like there's also maybe some bats moving from cave to cave, but for the most part, we're seeing these really dramatic declines in the number of hibernating bats.
Mantina, you talked about this, but maybe you can amplify the fact that North Carolina is on this kind of borderland leaves, it seems to me, interesting possibilities for the research you can do right here.
It does. I think that the more important question is, what's going to be the impact of the loss of the bats that we've lost so far? And it's just too early to tell what some of those unanswered questions about these bats in more southern latitudes, what will happen with them. But really, the big message here is that these bats, multiple species, and millions of individuals now perform this massive service of controlling insects. And we're going to have a loss of that service. And there's ecological ramifications. There's certainly economic ramifications because they control a lot of our crop pests as well. And so I think that question is one that is probably the biggest question that's looming.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program. Mantina Kakunis-Rappel is an associate professor of biology at UNC Greensboro. Gabriella Grader is a wildlife diversity biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, which is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.